Today's episode is brought to you by Oak Tree Products, the ultimate one-stop shop for audiologists, hearing professionals, and sound professionals. If you're looking for diagnostic or screening equipment, this is the place for you. From the essentials to the hard-to-find tools, Oak Tree has you covered. We've personally been ordering from them for years, and they've always come through. We recently just ordered new diagnostic equipment for four offices through Oak Tree.
During the pandemic, when supplies were hard to come by and everything was up in the air, Oak Tree kept things in stock and moving. They've handled supply chain disruptions, tariff uncertainty, all of it without missing a beat. Whether you're outfitting a new practice or just need to stock up, check them out at oaktreeproducts.com. Again, that's oaktreeproducts.com. We will link to them in the episode description and tell them we sent you when you visit oaktreeproducts.com. Today on Hear Us Out, we're joined by a legend of the guitar, Tommy Emmanuel. With a career spanning over five decades, including an APRA Award, multiple ARIA Awards, multiple CMAA Awards, a Grammy Award, and induction into the Australian Roll of Renown, Tommy isn't just known for his jaw-dropping technique and soulful playing. He's one of the few musicians in the world to hold the title of Certified Guitar Player, a rare honor bestowed by the great Chet Atkins himself. Beyond the accolades and the virtuosity, Tommy brings something even more powerful, joy, heart, and soul into every note he plays. In this episode, we go beyond the music to talk about what drives him, how he stays connected to his craft, and what it really means to live a life dedicated to creating. Whether you're a musician, a creative, or just someone who loves a good story, Tommy's wisdom, humor, and passion will leave you inspired. Tommy, welcome to Hear Us Out. My first question I have for you is going to combine our area and your area. I'm fascinated by the fact that you have not had formal training and you also have hearing loss. So can you talk about how you've learned to play by ear in spite of the fact that you have hearing loss?
Well, there are two things here. I was not aware of my hearing loss until I was in my early 40s.
Wow.
Yeah, I was not aware of it at all. And really, I just plowed on from when I was a kid. And I had to work out, with the help of my brother, I had an older brother, he's gone now, but I had an older brother who, because of, he was more advanced in years, but his ear was great. And he helped me to figure out how to hear the chord sequences in songs and things like that. And he could just hear a song on the radio and go, that's F, D minor, G minor, C, you know, and so, and I play it. My mother gave us some Mel Bay books with chords in them. And plus I learned a lot of chords from meeting other musicians along the way. But you have to remember that I started so young. Mm-hmm. It's hard for me to remember all the, exactly the evolution of my earlier years. I do know that there were certain signposts which pointed me to a direction. I think the first one was that I always had a great love for playing the rhythm guitar while my brother played the lead part. So I was always a natural accompanist. And because of that, I had to learn songs and the construction of the song and remember the chord secrets and all that. So we could just go into it and my brother would play all the singing part, really. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I ended up being a song player, a songwriter. And I was always interested in every instrument. By the time I was six, I was already tinkering on my brother's drum kit. I was trying to emulate what he was doing. And I could play something that resembled music on the drums already. And then the way that I heard music, because I was the accompanist, I had to try and emulate the sound that I got on, that was on the record. And the funny thing was, nobody mentioned that there was a bass guitar on the record. So I'm trying to find a way of playing the rhythm part that I'm hearing at this other part. I had to work it out, and so we could make the sound that was on the record. So by sheer necessity and ignorance, I figured out how to play bass parts with the rhythm and fill out the sound. So when my eldest brother played drums and I played the rhythm and moved the bass around, my brother Phil played the melody over the top. To us, it sounded like the record. But what I was really doing was playing the bass player's part and the rhythm player's part. I just didn't know that. So, and that, I guess you might call that a happy accident. I think it's nature's way. That prepared me for when I heard the great Chet Atkins on the radio. I immediately went, he's doing everything at once. And I knew it. And everybody was like, no, it's a recording trick. It's, you know, you can't do that. But I could hear it. And I was only 7 years old. And no one listens to a seven-year-old, you know. So what I did is I had to figure out for myself how he was doing it and work out how to make that sound.
You just did what you had to do.
Yeah, I just kept at it until I could play one of those songs and make that sound. So this is a long time ago. This is 1962, 63. But just getting back to my hearing deficit, I found out in my 40s that my mother had yellow fever because it was everywhere in Australia in the 50s. And so she gave it to me and I was born with it. And then I got pneumonia and they kept me in hospital for two months and I almost died. Oh, it's a miracle I made it. So, but I didn't know that I had damage caused by this fever. But, you know, I wear hearing aids. I can't hear for crap, to be honest, you know. But when I put headphones on, I love it. Because your voice sounds close to me. Mm-hmm. I can hear that, you know?
In those early years of your career, and you were side by side against people who did have that formal training from an early age, did that create any sort of insecurity for you to match up to these people? No.
No, because I could never understand why do they need to read all this stuff when you just hear the song once and you can play it. You know what I mean? I got to a point where even if I've never heard the song before, I lock onto it like a laser beam because, and I don't know when I figured this out, but every song has a pattern. And I could lock onto these patterns. And by a pattern, I mean, here's the verse, here's the second verse. Oh, it's the same pattern. Here's the chorus. Oh, that's a slightly different pattern. Here's the next verse. Back to that pattern. Now, here's the next chorus. There's that pattern. And then there's a bridge. Oh, that's a little different, you know. And I could lock onto it. And that's why I got so much work as a studio player. But I couldn't read music, you know. But I could hear something and I could play and come up with something immediately. No one told me to be, you know, feeling inadequate about my abilities. I was just keen and interested in playing and loved it and was, what's the word? I was uninhibited, you know, and I still am. I take a lot of risk every time I go on stage.
You had talked about early on with your brother that you're playing together and you would do rhythm, he would do lead. These days, so much of your show and your shows are solo. Can you talk about how when you do collaborate, like with somebody like Mike Dawes, that you leave space for another artist to fill within the music that you're creating?
With everybody, I try to be a listener first. You know, I want to hear them play. And particularly somebody like Mike Dawes, all his arrangements are for him to play. He doesn't need me, you know what I mean? So we try to find songs where he's got most of the arrangement happening, and I tend to say to him, me double the melody, and we'll make it strong. And then in this part here, when you go up high, I'll do something down low. And you know what I mean? So I try to use my sensitivity and my experience and try to come up with what's best for the music. How can I serve the song the best, you know?
Absolutely.
When I'm playing with people who don't do that, they always play all over me. You know what I mean? They're so keen to be impressive that they actually play all over you. And I end up kind of withdrawing almost just down to playing a little bass part because all the room is taken up. You know, the other thing that most musicians are not aware of is frequencies. Every instrument and every guitar player creates frequencies. So when I get together with another person to make music, I'm very aware that my frequencies are not canceling his or hers out. And I try to create a beauty in the space that underneath. And I love being an accompanist. It's one of my greatest joys.
You mentioned that when somebody is playing over you, you feel the need to step back. What is going through your mind in those situations? Is it a very quick switch that you have to change gears? Are you communicating with that person on stage? How does it all happen? To the audience, it seems seamless when a professional is doing that we won't notice. How do you create that seamless effect even when it's all happening in real time?
Thank heavens it doesn't happen too often, because normally if someone has written to my management and says, you know, here's a video of me playing. My dream is to play a duet with Tommy. So I'll have a look at it and see, first of all, how they play, what their time is like, what their sound is like, what their musicianship is like and all that. And if I feel, well, I'd really like to give them a chance with my audience, I'll invite them down to soundcheck and we'll have a little jam and see how it goes. If their attitude is that they're overplaying everything, then sometimes I just say, I don't think this will work. Or I'll let it happen and make them happy and say thank you and just do one song and that kind of thing, you know? But a lot of times when I get together with somebody and it's magical, they'll come out to do one song and I'll say, stay there, and I'll go into something else and force them to join me, you know what I mean? To spin it round.
Yep.
And we end up having a great time, and we end up making magic. Even if we've never rehearsed anything, sometimes it's sheer magic, you know? But then one of the great joys is when you play with somebody like Michael Cleveland on the fiddle, that he's not only so skilled and so sensitive and so musical that when you go to do something that's completely unrehearsed, he can sense when I'm ready for him to take the melody, and he just goes in like he can see and he can't, you know, and he's phenomenal. But this is the spiritual unseen part that happens between musicians, you know. Sorry, Michelle, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, can you think of a specific time of where magic was created spontaneously?
Almost every time. Almost.
So given your technical capability, can you also speak about the importance of sometimes the music just calls for simplicity and also silence and space within compositions you're creating?
Yeah, well, I'm always trying to be as sensitive as I can to the music, but at the same time, sensitive to my audience. I walk the line as a solo player, as an entertainer walking on stage. People have paid, they're in their seat, they want to have a good time. I walk the line of always, in parts of my show, I play way too much, you know? I push it beyond what my good taste would tell me. But I love that now I'm a little boy running up the hill, hanging on to my kite that is being lifted up by this wind. Now I'm going to see how high I can fly my kite. And I'm doing that in front of the audience to give them the thrill of this guy's like, holy hell, he's right out on the limb. And I'm going at it because I believe that's what people want to see. They don't want to see you playing it safe, you know. However, the other side of that is when I play certain songs like Angelina or It's Never Too Late or Stay Close to Me or Somewhere Over the Rainbow, songs like that. I do not mess with them. I play them with all my heart because I know I don't need to do anything. Everything is right. Just play.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Play it with all your heart. And that's my kind of welcome to my traveling circus.
We've spoken to a number of musicians now on the podcast, and a few of them have talked about if they've had instances of writer's block or creative burnout. Have you ever experienced that before? And if so, how have you pushed through it?
I've experienced it 1,000 times, both things, and I just play right through it. I stop worrying about not being able to write a song every day. A long time ago, you know, and my greatest desire is writing. I love writing, but it's so hard, and I can only write from a place of pure inspiration, and whatever that means and wherever it comes from. Sometimes things happen and I write, I get an idea and I just run with it, you know, but it doesn't happen every day. You know, there are days like yesterday is a classic example of we arrived into Royal Oak near Detroit. It was raining, it was cold, and I didn't have a good night's sleep. The bus was rolling around, and so I had to think backwards. I had to go, okay, at 8 o'clock tonight, I want to be in great shape. I better rest a bit more. So I rested. I had some breakfast. I talked to my children, and then I went back and I slept another 40 minutes or so, and it's all I needed. There I was back, and by that time the sun had come out. It was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I took a great walk, and it was Halloween and there were kids and families everywhere in the streets, and I thought, this is what I needed. I just needed to get out and moo a bit in the herd. And so I did that, and then I went in the hall and got my guitars. I changed strings on two of my guitars. And I played a little while, and then we did a sound check, and it was incredible. It's a big place, and I was told the show is sold out, and I was so amazed because I know how big the place is. I played there many times, and this was the first time that someone had said, guess what, sold out tonight. I couldn't believe it. I was so excited, so thrilled. So from then on, I was like Captain Fantastic. I was just like, holy hell, I can't believe I sold this place out. So we get the sound check done. We eat. The food comes in. I eat. I take a shave and a shower and get ready. I do two meet and greet, one for PBS, one VIPs. And the people are lovely, and I just had a great time with them. And it went on and on to like 20 minutes to 8. And then my lighting director, who sort of helps me out as well, comes to me and says, tuning in 5 minutes. And I said, oh, okay, thanks. So I got my tuner and showed me the back way around to the side of the stage. And I tuned my guitars and everything was ready. And then I went out for the first set. So I played two sets with an intermission last night. And I walked out and just looked out of this massive crowd. And they were yelling and screaming and people were standing up. And I was just like, I can't believe it, you know. And I just tore into it so much. In the first three songs, I ended up throwing my thumping into the audience because it was useless. I was like playing almost right through it. And I had to find a thumb pick that worked in my pocket that would hang on there so I could just tear into it. The first half hour was just like, you know, I was like a wild man, giving it everything for the audience. And they were just going off like crazy. So in the break, I went and went rooted through my stage bag and found my bag of thumb picks. And I found some really tight ones. So, okay, this will be good. And away I went. I played the second set, and we just had the greatest night. It was unbelievable. But if I hadn't had that little rest, I may not have had the kind of clarity that I had in my mind on the stage. I was literally flying. I jumped off the cliff and didn't care about anything, any stick and net. I was out there, and it was great. And that's what I love doing. If I see people playing and safe on stage, I don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, come on.
Push it.
Put your heart into it. You know, and I believe that that's what turns people on. It distracts them from them dissecting what you're doing or trying to analyze everything that's going on in front of them. All of a sudden, they're caught up in the energy that comes from that real place. And it's a place of love and joy, because this is what music brings to us, right? So if you're really doing it for real, and you know whoever's made you is watching, then holy smoke, it's going to wash over the whole audience.
You know, hearing you give that answer, I'm reminded of listening to you talk about music should be driven by feeling, and
absolutely,
you're also entertaining a crowd. So can you about how feeling and the desire to entertain interplay on stage?
Yeah. Well, it's a combination of discipline and taking risks, right? And the desire to see what can happen in this moment right now. You know, I know that there are times when I'm having fun and I'm cracking a lot of jokes and I'm making the audience laugh and I'm having a great time being that entertainer. I know that I reach a certain point and then I do something serious musically and it's gone like this, you know, that it's had its power. It's fun. Now there's this, all these emotions here, because we need all that, you know? So, and this is, I'm not saying I know all about it. What I'm saying is this is stuff that I've learned from real life and I've seen it work, and that's why I trust it.
It sounds like you're actively reading the room throughout a performance.
I'm doing both. I'm reading the room, and I'm also, when people sing out, I try to make out what they say. If I can't hear them because of my hearing, I'll ask somebody sitting in front of me, what did he say? You know, stuff like that.
If you're reading the audience while you're playing, does that take you at all away from being in the zone of playing, or can you really simultaneously do both?
I wake up in the zone. You're not going to get me out of the zone. The only way you're going to get me out of the zone is tell me something horrific, you know? Other than that, I'm in the zone.
That's great.
And so shifting gears a little bit, talking about the specific instruments you play and your Maiten guitars, do you play an active role in their design with the wood selection, the pickups, and the miking of the instrument, or do you leave that to the luthier?
I had no input as far as the choices of wood goes. I made one request in 40 years, and that was I wanted to try one with a cedar top.
And
I did, and it was beautiful and glorious, and I loved it. But my sound man, Steve, who is as sensitive as I am when it comes to sound, said to me, this guitar sounds great, but when you really tear into it and you're playing like Doc's guitar and Cannonball Rag, you're playing those fast things. He said, there's just too many frequencies that it's actually taking away from the clarity of your playing because there's so many frequencies. So I switch back to my normal one with a spruce top. And straight away, I totally got what he was talking about. And so because I love that guitar, I gave it to a friend of mine who's a wonderful guitar player in Japan. And he was visiting Nashville. He came in for the Chet convention, and I saw that he had a pretty ordinary Yamaha guitar. It was nice. Yamaha make great, good guitars. And I thought, I bet he'll love this guitar. So he came back to the green room before my show, and I grabbed the Cedar Top 808 out of the case, and I said, here, play this, Shohei. And he played it, and he's like, so beautiful. And so after the show, he came back to the dressing room, and I said, did you like the 808? He said, oh, so beautiful. I said, it's yours. And I gave it to him. So he plays it in concert now.
Yeah. Awesome.
As far as the electronics with the mates go, I mean, they did all the work in the early days, and I was the guinea pig, as I still am, you know. You're talking mid-80s when they were building their guitars and trying to get the pickup right. It took a long time. I kept telling them, the bass is not right. It doesn't sound like a guitar. It sounds too woofy. The high end is too glassy. Stuff, all this sort of stuff. And they'd be backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards. And they finally came up with the AP5 with a mic. And yeah, my input was basically this. I said to them, Takamine are killing you. Takamine make a much better pickup, and you can turn it up loud, you know? And they make a model that has a microphone connected to the bottom of it. I said, you need to make a pickup that sounds a bit like that, but has even better sound with the microphone and stuff like that. And you need to get rid of 9-volt batteries in your guitar. They're too heavy, and you have to take the strings off to get in to change the batteries. You need AA batteries, and they need to go in the top, so you can just pop them out, put new ones in, pop it in. And I want to have the microphone on a separate send, but I still want to use a normal guitar cable, not a stereo cable. And they're like, this has never been done. And I said, let's do it. So that's kind of how it came about. It's the same thing with the AER Compact 60 amp. I got involved with AER when Udo Rosner owned the company. And all his amps were brilliant, but they had things about them that were useless for a guy like me. They had a compression built in that you couldn't get rid of. I don't want compression, you know? And then they had they choruses and delays and all these things and all these different sounds. And I didn't need any of that, you know? So all the amps that they let me try out, play through, I said, they all sound great, but I don't need all this other stuff. Can you build me an amp that has one long reverb, one short reverb? That's it. And that has bass, middle, and treble, and a master volume and a channel volume. That's it. And he said, that's it? And I said, that's all I want. One good sound. So Udo went away and made the Compact 60, and boom, that thing became the industry standard for acoustic guitar players plugging in. Everybody wanted one, you know?
And do you feel like that allowed you to have a more consistent sound on stage?
Absolutely. The thing is, you got to remember that the PA is what everyone hears. That's your world. You know, your world is not what's going on stage. It's what's coming out the PA. And my sound man, Steve, we run everything flat. We don't go EQing and tearing things out. We run things as flat as we can, because our ears love all those frequencies. So how do we make them sound nice, you know? So basically, when people come to my concert, they're hearing two signals from my guitar direct into an AER preamp, and everything's set flat. And then I go into the Udo Rosner amplifier, everything set flat and straight into the PA. So it's two big flat signals. That's how you get the sound. And I EQ the guitar on the guitar. You know what I mean?
Like, yep.
I run the guitar and the microphone, the pickup of the microphone, they're full out. They're as loud as you can get them, right? And then I use a mid-range to find the good sound, and bass and treble about three quarters, and turn that thing up, put it in a PA, boom.
Off
there's
you go.
Every frequency I like right there.
And given the differences, generally speaking, on that you have your PA system and then you're going to have your monitor system on stage, can you talk about how your hearing loss may impact what you need out of those monitors? And when you're playing with somebody else, how you manage that with the wedges or in-ears?
I don't use in-ears. I have my hearing aids in on stage.
Wow.
And so everything is killing me. It's so bright because of my hearing aids are designed for me to hear you speaking, female and male voice. Mm-hmm. And so there's loss in some areas, and they've spiked some of the like high mids and stuff.
Yep.
So I had to get used to that kind of clarity, but I grew to like it because I heard all the detail in my playing. So I was able to tidy up my playing that much better. So basically my normal setup on stage is side fill at the side. Sometimes, like last night, it looked like the top part of
a... I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
Three employees and two work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Blind array PA. It was big. And it was on both sides of the stage. And I had it so it was like big and loud, but it wasn't killing me, but it was this close to killing me. And that's how I like it.
Wow.
And I had my voice in the monitors. Basically, I have two side fill, two monitors in front. And the microphone for me singing and talking is coming out those two monitors, and the guitar is coming out the side fill and out my amp down beside me. So it's a big sound and it's beautiful, you know?
Absolutely.
Now, how, in all your years of playing, have you had any instances of something going wrong, whether a tech glitch, whether something happened to your guitar? Has anything ever gone wrong, and how have you dealt with it on stage?
Hundreds and hundreds of times, yes. I've had pretty much every situation you can imagine. I've had the electronics go out in one of my early Maiden guitars. Something was wrong, and I couldn't fix it, so I just popped out the whole cover, and I sat down and grabbed the microphone and put it down. And played the rest of the show on the microphone, and it was fine. Yeah, I've been where my amp blew up, something happened, so I just carried on with the direct signal, and it was fine. What else have I had? I've had situations where two of my guitars never arrived for like 4 days because the airline couldn't trace them. Yeah, and so I had to play the first four shows of like a 36-day tour with one guitar, hoping that nothing would happen, right? And sure enough, first show, I broke a string about second song in. So I had to quickly change the string and make it a workshop for the audience, show them how I put a string on, stretch it in, and you do this, and right, there you go, then you get it, shoot it, and then carry on. And I just made it part of the show, you know?
So, and would you then alter the set or the songs you were playing so that you're not switching back and forth with different tunings?
That's why I have other guitars.
Right, where it's going wrong.
Well, in the situation like that, I mean, the only tuning I would go to would be a drop D.
Okay. You know?
Yeah, because if you start going like down to C6 and all that stuff, you're going to be chasing your tuning the whole time.
Whole night, yeah.
So that's another reason why I tour with three guitars, because firstly, I've got a spare. If I break a string, I could just pick one of the other ones up. But those other two guitars are in different tunings, you know? So I don't want to be tuning much. I don't want to be out of tune, and I don't want to be tuning. You know, it drives me crazy when I see other artists who only carry one guitar, and then they play all these songs in really strange tunings, you know? And then they play one song, and the audience are totally with them. And now the next song is in a different tuning. So they got to retune and tell this long story so they can get the guitar in tune. And now they've lost the audience already. And then they play the second song, and halfway through it, their guitarist starts to go out of tune because it can't get it. It can't settle in with the pressure being up here, then down there, and up here and down there. You know, I just don't understand why people do that. Why they think it's okay. I call it unprofessional, absolutely unprofessional, you know. And if I'm having tuning issues, I tell the audience, hey, I'm arguing with my tuner tonight. It's telling me I'm in tune. My ear's telling me, no, it's not. So just give me a second, I'll get it tuned, you know. I involve my audience in everything.
It helps further the connection with them when you're being upfront with them and making them part of it.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And there have been times when someone's sung out for a song and I've confidently gone into it, but I realize I haven't played this song for 5 years or something. Oh, it'll be right. I'm playing away and then I forget the bridge. And I stop and go, you know what? I'm having a senior moment. I'm going to start again. And I know that if I go back to the top, it'll come back, you know? So, yeah. There's no point in trying to hide stuff from the audience. Just be honest. Just be vulnerable. Just be open. Tell them everything.
You know, we've spoken to sound designers, sound engineers who work around the world. And one of the ideas that I found fascinating that they brought up was how different cultures, different regions will have different sonic preferences. And you were talking about running your system very flat. Do you think about the regions that you're in and what sonic preferences might be in different regions? Or are you just thinking, this is how I perform and they're here to see me, I'm going to give them me?
Well, I don't know about sonic preferences. I do know about musical styles. I mean, for instance, a guy like Pat Metheny will play to 10,000 people in Amsterdam with his band, and it will be incredible music. Sophisticated music, just unbelievable, you know. But you know, he still plays smaller places in America because of their tastes. In Europe, their taste is different. As sonically, I always try to go for the naturals, the biggest and most natural sound that we can get from whatever PA we're dealing with. You know, and like, for instance, German PAs like D&B. Oh, my God. When you play through a big, big system, you just can't believe the size of the sound. It's so beautiful. And for me, my greatest thrill is playing through a big, beautiful system where you feel like you're diving into the sound, you know. I remember, what was the name of the theater? I can't remember the name of it now off the top of my head, but I played there many times in San Diego. And Joe Satriani was on the next night, and his crew had put his big PA in the house. And I rang Joe and I said, hey, Joe, can I use your PA instead of the house PA? He said, yeah, brother, go, you know, have it. Well, what a treat that was. Mm-hmm. What a treat. Oh, my God. This massive PA for a big rock show with just acoustic guitar in it. Heaven. Talk about heaven.
Sounds like it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So we've talked to some musicians. We've talked to some people who have been on Broadway, and they've talked about some of the misconceptions people tend to have about the music life or life on the road, that we assume it's all glitz and glamour, but there are challenges associated with it. Can you talk about some of those perks and challenges of being a touring musician.
Okay, let's get this straight. There is no glitz and there's no glamour. Okay? So you can forget those things. There's hard work. There's dedication. There's a lot of great experiences. And as long as you remember that you can't please everybody, you know, if you want the formula for success, I don't know what that is, but I could tell you how to fail. And that's trying to please everybody. I think having an attitude of gratitude is an important part of being in the music business. Because if you really have worked hard and you're starting to get somewhere and you're making a good living playing music, then how much better can your life be? If you're making a living, you're paying for your house, you're making your car payment, you're putting your children through school, and you're in the happiness business. You play and people get happy. I mean, what more do you want? You know, so everything comes at a price. You know, I'm sitting here in this bus that I'm renting for this tour. And on this bus is my sound man and tour manager, my lighting director, and my merchandise lady and my driver. That's it. And I have to sleep in a little bunk there and I have to shower in the halls. You know, it's not a glamorous life. However, aren't I lucky? I've got a bus. I've got a bunk. I'm being paid. People are coming to see me play. What more do you want? You know, it's really
good outlook.
It's a fabulous life. But I'm going to tell you straight up, if you're not willing to work harder than everybody else, then you're never, ever going to make it. You're going to stay in your small little mindedness and in your safety area and become a jaded, angry old guitar player who hates to see people doing what they love. You know, so I've met so many people like that. And I just want to tell them, if you were willing to work as hard as I work, you'd be up there too. So stop wasting time, you know.
That actually brings up a point that I've been wrestling with lately. I'm sure over your years of playing, you've met a ton of people and some of them who you probably don't care for. How do you manage when you really like an artist and the art that they create and the music they create, but God, they're just an asshole, or you just don't like them? How do you separate? Can you separate the art from the artist?
I've worked with a lot of people that I don't understand, and I would be the first to admit that I will never understand the human race. But I try to be accepting of people, and I try to get rid of my judgment. I don't want to be judgmental of anybody. That's part of our makeup that always rises up. You know, I try my hardest to not be judgmental and just accept people the way they are. There are some people that I can work with and I love working with. And the people that I really love, that we have a magic together musically and as people, I mean, they're my family. You know, I love them as much as I love my own family. But there are certain people that I disagree with how they treat other people. I disagree with the walls that they've surrounded themselves with. And I don't need to be... I have no desire to interact with them, you know, but I don't want to be judgmental, but at the same time, I don't want to waste my time. My time is too precious, you know?
Absolutely.
So, and there've been some people that I've admired for a long time that are not doing near as well as I am. And I have offered them a situation where, look, we don't need a band. You come and play and just be you. You let me be the accompanist and we do this and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, you'll make more money than you made before. You'll have a great time. It'll be just easy. It'll be just you and me. No, they don't want to do that. They want to stay where they are, play with their band, and that's it. All right. Okay. All right. You know, that's fine.
So I've seen recently the world is being taken over by AI. I've seen... You can create images with AI. You can create commercials with AI. Music can be created with AI. How do you think musicians can work on keeping the focus of acoustic music alive with the world shifting towards AI?
Well, let me first say that I have nothing to do with AI. I don't understand. I know how brilliant it is because a friend of mine 2 years ago demonstrated something with his phone. He said, look at this. And he said this story about me into his phone, and it wrote this whole song about me with all the info he gave the AI, whatever it was. And it was brilliant. But it's not Billy Strings playing the guitar. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So everybody's talking about AI, and those of us who play and do what we do from birth onwards, we don't really give a damn about it. You know, I don't care less about it. I still love playing my music, and I still love listening to people who do it in a great way. So, you know, you can always tell when something lacks humanity or lacks a certain sensitivity. You know, you can imitate it, but a person with half a brain can hear, oh, that's, I know how they did that. I know what computer they used, you know.
Something's missing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's called this here, right here.
Yep. So for my last question, one of the questions we've really enjoyed asking on the podcast is, can you think of a time where you got to become a part of somebody's story? When we spoke with Mike Dawes, he had referenced you in that context and the relationship the two of you have established. Can you talk about a time through your music, your career, where you feel like you got to really have an impact with somebody?
Well, there's been quite a few, and they're people that I love dearly. I was playing in the city of Rijeka in Croatia a long time ago. I'll tell you how long ago it was. It was 17 years ago. And there was a family in the audience, and they had a 3-year-old son, and he was already interested in playing classical guitar. And they had a little tiny guitar, and he was already getting lessons, and he was already, you could see by his hands that he was already onto it, you know. And his name is Frano, and so he came to that show with his mom and dad, and the next day they did a review of my show, and I was on the front page of the newspaper, and they shot this photo right past me into the audience. There he is, this little boy like this, like that. And that's Frano, right? So then the next time I came back to Rijeka 2 years later, he's 5 years old. He's already got a slightly bigger guitar, and he's already playing some classical pieces that are not easy, and he's doing very well. And he's working on trying to work out some of my songs. So then I see him the following year, and I was playing at like a basketball stadium place in Zagreb, and his mom and dad brought him to the dressing room with his guitar, and holy smoke, he was good, you know? And I got him up to play, and he just played with such confidence, with such bravado. I just couldn't believe it. And he was truly amazing. Frano now is 20, nearly 21. And a number of years ago, I gave him my very favorite and my greatest guitar that I've ever owned, the best Maiden I've ever owned with the best microphone and pickup system. I gave it to Frano when he was about 16. And he still plays it. And the guy is so brilliant. He's writing great. I mean, he is going to really lead the world of fingerstyle guitar into the next millennium. You know, he's going to be a real leader. He's a great person. He's a fabulous guy.
Who is somebody who you have not yet collaborated with that you would want to one day?
Taylor Swift.
Wow.
I would love to even just play on one of her tracks. I would love it. She's so incredible. You know, her work is on a level that we all can just look at in amazement. You know, she's so creative, and her records sound, you know, so amazing. They really do. So I would love a chance to work with her.
Wow. Maybe that will get to happen.
I did not expect that.
A seed was planted here.
Yes. Well, Tommy, it's been an absolute pleasure getting to chat with you. We had seen you a couple of years back and said we really would love the chance to talk to you one day. And now we got our shot.
Where was that at, Michelle?
At SOPAC in South Orange.
So you're in Jersey area.
Yes. So State Theater next week.
Yes.
Aha. Well, let's get some dwarfy.
Why don't you tell our listeners where they can find you next and how they can connect with you and your music?
All right. Well, my website is www.tommyemmanuel.com. You can just push on tours and all my dates will come up and you can get tickets there. If you want to hear my music, you can go to Spotify or Pandora, any of those things. I'm in the million streaming club on those sites, and I'm very grateful for that. And you can go onto YouTube and just put my name in there and you can have a look. I mean, most of my songs have official videos with the song. I mean, there's a lot of live stuff there. There's a lot of old stuff there too, back when I had hair and teeth. So, hey, listen, I want to thank you for this wonderful time spent. And I always feel bad at the end of an interview like this because I realized I'd been talking so passionately about what I do and I don't have any other way of doing it.
That's exactly what we want.
Yeah, we like when the episode is not about us, it's about our guest. We want to hear directly from you what you have to say. So we're grateful you took the time to share your stories and your insight with us.